New Jersey officials aren't taking over Atlantic City just yet. I'm Brad Linder, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller's off tonight. Governor Chris Christie and state lawmakers are giving the down-on-its-luck resort town 5 months to get its financial house in order before initiating a takeover. With the clock ticking down, Atlantic City officials are trying to figure out how to cut costs and raise revenues. WHYY's Joe Hernandez has this report on a meeting last night.
Mayor Don Guardian says Atlantic City has not been in good financial shape for a while, but he says measures such as privatizing utilities and cutting salaries were never palatable before.
The things that we're going to be talking about now that we're taking action on was unacceptable either to the police or to the fire or to the residents or to the city a couple of years ago. But as we are now in financial trouble, everyone is back on board saying we got to do some really drastic action.
Some of those things include wage freezes, staff reduction, and a lot more parking meters. The city is also considering other measures to cut costs, including hiking healthcare copays for city workers and selling more public property. On top of that, Guardian says he'll meet with mayors of nearby towns to talk about sharing trash pickup, parking enforcement, and other services. But some at the meeting said that might not be enough. One resident, who identified herself only as Mindy, said the city should try harder to attract new business.
And one of the things that we need here is much better. Actually, we don't even have it. We need PR. We need to get out there and tell everybody how great we are and what we can offer, and to bring private sectors in here as well.
Atlantic City will have to work out all the kinks before November, when the Christie administration is set to decide whether a takeover is in the cards. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Judges are elected in Pennsylvania, but judicial reform advocates in the state want to use merit selection to choose high-ranking judges. That means those judges would be appointed and confirmed rather than elected. And after decades of pushing for the change, reform advocates say they're making real progress. A merit selection bill is ready for action in the state house, but WHYY's Dave Davies says it may not get to a vote because lawmakers are preoccupied with resolving a state budget.
Merit selection would be a really big deal if it were to happen, but the bill already voted out of committee in the Pennsylvania House has pretty much flown under the radar, as most of the Capitol is focused on the wrangling between Governor Tom Wolf and Republican legislative leaders over taxes and education funding. The lead sponsor of the merit selection bill is Brian Cutler of Lancaster County, a member of the House Republican leadership. He's been working his colleagues.
It's a lot of one-on-one appointments, going to sit down, talk to folks, explain the idea to them.
The idea is that judges to statewide appellate courts, that Superior Commonwealth and the Supreme Court, would no longer be elected. The governor would appoint them from a list recommended by a panel of lawyers and non-lawyers. The appointees would be subject to confirmation by the state Senate, and after 4 years on the bench, they would have to face voters in a retention election. Lynn Marks has spent most of her career fighting for merit selection and other judicial reforms.
This constitutional amendment would get our statewide judges out of the campaign and out of the fundraising business.
Marks and others have long argued it's unseemly for judges to have to raise money from lawyers and other interests who will eventually appear before them in court. But appointing judges has determined critics, too. They object to calling it merit selection.
It's really political selection.
That's Tom Previck, public affairs director of the Pennsylvania Association for Justice, formerly known as the Trial Lawyers Association.
So we're going to take the right of voting from millions of voters in Pennsylvania, and we're going to put it in the hands of a handful of politicians in Harrisburg.
The Harrisburg politicians Previck refers to are the governor and state legislative leaders, which would appoint the panel that reviews and recommends candidates for judicial posts. Critics of the current system of electing judges say those millions of voters mostly have no idea who they're voting for, and in the end, a handful of political leaders end up picking who gets nominated to be put on the ballot anyway. But opposition from the trial lawyers, as well as labor unions and anti-abortion rights groups, have defeated past merit selection efforts. The idea got more traction in this legislative session. One reason, says the Democratic co-sponsor, Montgomery County State Representative Madeline Dean, is the spending on three Pennsylvania State Supreme Court seats last year.
It was $16 million. spent in those judicial elections.
That set a national spending record for judicial elections. Another factor, Dean says, is the departure of three Supreme Court justices in the last 2 years following allegations of improper and, in one case, criminal conduct. Dean says when you elect judges, in effect, anything can happen.
In the end, what happens is special interest rule the day. Sometimes ballot position, random things as ballot position will rule the day, instead of actually the qualifications of the person to be a fair and impartial jurist.
Sponsors say they're confident they have the votes for passage in the state House and are hopeful it would clear the Senate. But to meet deadlines associated with the constitutional amendment, which this measure is, it would need to pass before the legislature adjourns for the summer. The bill would then have to pass the legislature again in the next session and prevail in a voter referendum to secure the constitutional change. Legislative leaders are now preoccupied with the budget, and as the days and hours pass, it appears less and less likely they'll get to merit selection in this session. But there's still some hope, and there's always next year. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Checking the forecast, clear skies with a low around 65 degrees tonight. Tomorrow, sunny with a high near 88 degrees. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a chance of showers and a low near 69. It's 85 degrees at 6:12. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. A group of North Philadelphia community members is running a series of events to focus on the region's potential and cultural resilience. The Unleashing North Philly series is taking place in an area that's often more associated with poverty and crime. Community advocate Malcolm Kenyatta recently organized an event with the theme of childhood trauma. Ann Hoffman from WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk was there.
Children in North Philadelphia are vulnerable to something mental health professionals call toxic stress. It refers to prolonged and constant exposure to adversity, including poverty and violence. Over time, it can change how people respond to stress, and it can cause anxiety and depression. Educators, civil servants, community members, social workers, and others came out to the event to better understand and meet the needs of these children. Among them was Aaliyah Hatch. She works with middle school kids in North Philadelphia. She says after the panel, she wants to approach her students with more empathy.
From my end of things, just constantly making sure that the space is safe for them to process, to consider their trauma, but be able to move through it too.
That honoring of a child's emotional process is important, says one of the panelists, Reggie Jones, who heads up counseling at Bryn Mawr College. She says some of her clients come from poor neighborhoods and are succeeding in college, but using a coping strategy that worries her.
You know, you just sort of put the trauma on a shelf and you move forward. And it works for a while, but the disservice that we end up doing to folks is that we don't allow them to have other coping strategies available to them. So when that breaks down, they're stuck.
The cumulative social effect of widespread trauma, she says, is hopelessness. But Jones says focusing on small achievements or personal changes, like employing mindfulness in daily life, can make a huge difference. The next Unleash North Philly event will focus on voter turnout. Ann Hoffman, WHYY News.
During this presidential election year, many looked to factcheck.org to determine the truthfulness of claims made by candidates. Last year, the University of Pennsylvania-based project spun off SciCheck, focusing on false and misleading scientific claims made to influence public policy and voting decisions. NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller sat down with Vanessa Schipani, science writer for factcheck.org, to learn more about the project.
I suspect it's been a busy season so far.
Yeah, it's been quite busy, I'd say.
What's the current headline?
The last piece that I wrote was on blood donations from gay and bisexual men, which was
pertaining to the Orlando shooting.
Exactly, yeah. So that kind of reignited a debate about whether or not men who have sex with men should be able to donate blood. And we had some Congress members saying that the scientific basis of the FDA's decision to make it a one-year deferral, which means celibacy for 1 year, was not based in science, whereas obviously the White House was saying that it was. And they were both kind of right and kind of wrong.
I believe it was back in April. North Dakota's junior senator alleged that Zika will be throughout the United States.
Right. That was, yeah, a Democrat. She said that it was going to be throughout the United States, but that was a bit exaggerated. You know, the evidence shows that compared to areas like Puerto Rico, the continental United States will not be hit quite as bad by Zika. They predict that it won't be a widespread epidemic.
I'm going to guess that stretching the truth is not unique and exclusive to Democrats.
No, it's definitely not.
Would
it goes
you care
both
to
ways.
Bring us a Donald Trump example? How about the water drought in California?
He was saying that the drought in California was man-made. It actually is really complex. It's not just one cause. And part of it has to do with the infrastructure of California. But he said that there was no drought to begin with. And obviously, we know that California is definitely going through a drought. It's in its fifth year of an extreme drought.
Not to pick on the Donald, but he was also at one point railing against windmills.
Right, exactly. So he said that windmills were killing all the eagles, and we know that there are still eagles in existence, so that's not true. And so for that article, I kind of looked at exactly how many birds are being killed. Eagles and other birds are being killed by windmills, and how it compares to other causes like birds flying into buildings, or actually the biggest killer of birds in the United States is cats, of course.
Does your work come to a crescendo in November, or is it 24/7, 365?
My position is a bit different than my colleagues. I concentrate a little bit more on policy versus politics. So I review a lot of congressional hearings, for example.
What's a neat example of a recent congressional hearing that you were interested in?
Well, I reviewed recently a hearing. It was called, I might be off slightly on this, but it was called Sound Science at the EPA. It was for the House Science Committee. The witness was Gina McCarthy, the administrator at the EPA. And so they asked her a lot of questions about the Clean Power Plan and the National Ambient Air Quality Standard and the Paris Deal. And so they were trying to get a handle on how exactly the EPA uses science to make its policy decisions.
What you bring to the conversation is certainly interesting. A journalist, yes, but also a background in subjects including philosophy and history. How is that brought to bear to do your work?
So I studied the history and philosophy of science. One thing that I've noticed from doing this job, and one reason why I think it's such an interesting job, is because there's a separation between how scientists think about their work and how everyone else does. I think that on many occasions, politicians misunderstand the scientific process. So, for example, they think that there will be 100% proof for climate change. When climate scientists, you know, I did an interview with Michael Mann, who's a top climate scientist, and he says, we're pretty darn sure. But the nature of science is not to give proof, it's to give support. That's science 101.
So pretty darn sure is the acid test in this case.
They have accumulated enough evidence to say, yes, man-made climate change or man-made global warming, there's a slight difference between those two. And I actually wrote an article about that, but that it's occurring. But politicians will say, well, we want 100% proof. It'll never happen. But that doesn't mean that they don't have a bunch of evidence to support it. And that's something that I learned from studying the history and philosophy of science, that people misconstrue what science can give you.
Where is the funding in place for your organization's work?
So the Stanton Foundation funds SciCheck. So I'd definitely like to thank them for funding that and continuing SciCheck.
Thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
No problem. Thank you.
That's NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller speaking with Vanessa Schipani, science writer for FactCheck.org. Finally tonight, volunteers with the Democratic National Convention rolled up their sleeves in West Philadelphia today to help build a new community garden. The one-acre garden sits behind the Pediatric Care Center run by the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Reverend Leah Daughtry, CEO of the Democratic National Convention Committee, contrasted the large scale of the national politics with the project's local scope.
We can talk about what happens largely and broadly across this country, but what we have here today is our commitment to one local community and one hospital and one community garden.
The garden's expected to feed up to 20 families a week throughout the growing season. They'll grow vegetables like eggplants and squash, but also fruits like apples and pears. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Brad Linders for NewsWorks Tonight.